Well, hi everybody and welcome. First, thank you for your kind words and the feedback that I've gotten by email from our first seminar and for some of your suggestions based on the most important question you have and what you'd most like to take away. So I want to indicate I'll be departing from the outline just a bit to incorporate this, and especially to follow a suggestion or suggestions about application of coaching experience and how can we apply this with maybe some coaching vignettes or aspects. And I have a couple that I think are very common coaching issues that I think each of you will experience. But first, let me ask, is there anything you want to add or ask or comment before we go on lecture mode? Anything you want to add to the hopper about what you'd like to be sure right. that we discuss? Final call. If not, I'll go directly to our lecture mode. Any thoughts or questions you want to add?
I don't have any.
Okay. All right. Well, that's official then. I'll go on. Okay. We're going to talk in this seminar about mastering states of mind in coaching. I believe that this is the most important variable that we can do in coaching, is to help a client regulate a state of mind and manage emotion for optimum effectiveness. So first, let's review just what we're talking about in terms of understanding a state of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that then determines how we perceive and how we process information and then how we respond. So a state of mind, like a software program, is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavioral patterns. So a key element in mentor coaching is to help a client become aware of this process, aware of their experience, their state of mind, and specifically what works best for what task. Often, for many of our clients, the first issue will be regulating a state of mind, so that there's not an instant reaction from a particular state. And I'll give some examples of that in just a minute. But an illustration of how states of mind are like different software packages. If you put a rat in a maze and teach it to get to the goal, the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you, before teaching that rat, inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, just slightly alter its state, analogous to an excited state, and teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't get to the cheese. It can literally, in that maze, die of starvation, even though it has a part of its brain, the information about how to get to the cheese, but it can't access it. It's state-dependent learning and state-dependent memory. It's specific to that state. So this is what we see, for example, in PTSD. Somebody instantly activates a state of mind and they're back in the trauma all over again. A more common example is you try to think of somebody's name And you can't, you know it. You know it's on the tip of your tongue, but you just can't recall it. Then, later in a more relaxed state, boom, the name comes to mind. So, again, a state of mind is like a mind-body state, a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. Now, each of us has a range of states with some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even of how to enter and exit different states. It's important to become aware of which state to enter for a creative endeavor, for example, what state to enter for conceptual planning, what state of attention and concentration works best from the alertness of business endeavors to relaxation for sleep. I'll give you a case example in just a moment, but I want to expand this a little bit before applying. The regulation of feelings and states of mind involves understanding of how we access different states. For example, there's no more poignant an example about regulation of state of mind than with artists and writers who enter a creative state. Damien Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to enter the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite nonfiction writers, Diane Ackerman, wrote on a pine plank while soaking in a bathtub to get that floaty, free thought experience. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm and immediately come back to recreate his experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. The corresponding state of mind of the reader often matches with that of the author, as the author guides the reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of imagery, the rhythm of feelings. The most natural method of regulating state change is distraction, such as jangling car keys to shift the crying, inconsolable infant to an alert, calmer state to notice the keys. We each have various ways to reconnect the mind and body, such as getting grounded in physical activity, a walk outdoors, a warm bath, breathing exercises. I want to discuss how we can apply this to work with clients in just a moment. It's important, I think, for us as a mentor coach to really understand and resonate with the mind-body state of the client to understand their subjective experience as well as the story communicated by that. So this is important that once we're tuned into the client, we can resonate or receive empathically communication of all forms, not just verbal. Together, we can explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, plan. This resonance also creatively transforms the experience into new ideas, co-creations beyond where either might have gone before. So we have to allow this kind of right brain engagement, midbrain to midbrain with the client to take in emotional communication, to hold unexplained experiences, feelings, and ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. It's a way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It's really the art and science of mentor coaching. So here's an illustration just of an everyday example to understand and recognize emotional couplings. Regardless of how logical you think you are, your first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Any input goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain, then to the hippocampus, still in the midbrain, where meaning is attached. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually to make logical sense. A footnote here from a former psychoanalyst, the hippocampus is the primary location of the unconscious. It's where meanings are attached. Everything at the midbrain level is an unconscious process. Notice the emotional activation registered before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess options. And neuroscientists have demonstrated that we make decisions, especially buy or purchase decisions, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of them. This has been shown in some sophisticated studies from neuroeconomics labs. Once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment, a yes or a no, for example, then the conscious mind seeks to gather all the reasons to make that decision make sense. And this rationalization can be confirmation bias. So when we make a choice, we couple memory and wisdom from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. I want to return, probably not in this seminar, but what that means in terms of clients who are making unprecedented decisions, decisions for which they have never experienced anything like it before, transformational experiences. And what that means is that existing models that are used automatically to simulate new decision material may be outdated, like old software. Similarly, intuition, which uses this unconscious process, may also misinform because it's based on already existing experiences, perhaps not applicable to this new and different situation. But we'll come back to that. So think about how, for example, credit cards decouple buying, that's an activation of the immediate decision to purchase based on our identity, and pain, which is the pain center of the brain, the buying, the activation of the pleasure center, and the pain center are decoupled. So the pleasure of the purchase is segmented from the pain of future payment. This segmentation renders repayment a future abstraction. We'll do it in the future. We can put off pain and engage the pleasure now, and that can lead to some lousy or even addictive spending decision. One application. It's hard to say because of the way our minds work and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying. Making spending money both activate the pleasure center of the brain mediated by dopamine. And it's really difficult to substitute a theory, future need, long-term saving, retirement, which is a future abstraction. So let's look at immediately how to regulate a state of mind. The most important thing we can do to achieve success, I believe, is to develop the ability to manage emotions and regulate state of mind to make balanced decisions. So what do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind using drug, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotion can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you choose, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. I'll give some practical examples in just a bit. Now, there are a couple of ways to regulate a state of mind. One is physiology and one is focus. Physiology, for example, focusing on deep breathing in relaxation, breathing out any tension. focus, what and how you focus. We know from quantum physics and brain science, we get what we focus on, not what we want. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain. What you pay attention to determines your state of mind, and your state of mind determines the meaning you attach to something. So your power is what you focus on. So here's a simple example. Two examples. One, the simple coaching model that we use most often is to ask a client for this session, what would you like us to focus on? And the client determines the focus, and then where would you like us to get to? Those are the two coordinates of the map that we develop the coaching story of that session. And that story has a beginning, middle, and end. Three components to every story: the challenge, the development, the resolution. And we then help the client together to successively approximate the resolution or the outcome that they want. Here's another simple example of, you know, where you focus matters. My wife and I did the BMW Racing School for 3 days, pro racers. One of the first things that we were told as we were about to do circles at high speeds on slippery pavement, the instructor said, focus on where you're going, not what you want to avoid. That's an instantaneous one-second decision because your brain and what you do follows your focus. Focus on where you want to go, not what you want to avoid. We know from working with clients, when they stop themselves in the present moment and focus on problems or what they want to avoid, they're engaging what has already been laid as a pathway in their brain that is by definition not working. So this is, I think, important as we consider looking together at how we're collaboratively approaching the client's goal for each session. So let's revisit now the idea of state of mind. Here's a brief story. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th out of their division of 217 teams. They were dead last in free shots. So what Reed did was have his players develop a mantra before each free shot. A mantra is three parts: a cue, a focus, a physiology. He suggested the cue, just to cue their awareness of their state, to be to dribble the basketball, and a mantra that they would use to align the energy field of their brain while they're dribbling. This whole thing takes maybe 3 seconds. A mantra such as relaxed and smooth, and at the same time taking a deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. So the cue, the focus, the physiology, the dribble, the focus phrase, and the deep breath, and he had them do that before each free shot. Then additionally, during practice, he would suddenly blow the whistle, have them go to the free shot line. If they made both, they got a break. If they didn't, 4 laps. And this simulated a game condition where you suddenly are fouled, for example. You're probably on tilt, probably tired. You don't get to, in a game, you don't get to go free shot, take 30 free shots and count your best. So when he did this, after 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide in free shots. So mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. I worked with two clients today who began work with me because this was exactly what they needed to work on. One, a pro athlete who had been referred because he was increasingly distracted because he had gotten into situations where he had been angry, gotten penalties, and that sort of thing. Another, a physician who instantly had difficulties in his practice and in his personal life because of regulation of state of mind. I won't go into detail more, but it was simply a regulation of state of mind that he would distract himself into an addictive behavior that then created a kind of balance for him. So for both, it was to recognize the instant that their state changed with some emotional trigger. Let me give you a kind of a case study that I can go into a little bit more detail. A woman I'll call Barbara came to me for mentor coaching, and we were doing some really enjoyable, and she was doing some excellent work with executive coaching. And right before the holiday that year, and that was Thanksgiving, she said, "Dave, I'm about to go home for the holiday." She was in her early 50s. "Every year, I get into the same situation with my family. I have all intent and every resolve to stay really focused, enjoy my time, not get into fights with my family." And she described a little bit of how she would get into fights with each. And she could last for a day, maybe a day and a half, but then she'd lose it, and it would be the same place each time. So I asked her before we met, we had one more meeting before she was to go home for the major holiday that year, which was Thanksgiving, and I asked her to schedule an appointment with herself and to write into two columns. One, what she recognized the emotional trigger was, and she immediately knew a couple of examples. A word her mother would use, the way her dad would roll his eyes, how her sister would nudge her to get upset, what each trigger was and how she responded. What was her response to that trigger? What was the specific kind of upset or anger or negative self-talk, whatever it was, in that response column? She did that and did some really reflective work that she said was hard, and she recognized what she needed to do, and to recognize it earlier, not to dwell on it, but just to recognize it in order to get grounded and centered. And what she decided for a mantra, a cue, a focus, a physiology, to get grounded and centered was that she would touch her ring as a cue while she was taking a deep breath, and she used a focus phrase for her, which was just relaxed. And I urged her to practice that and to, for each emotional trigger, to have in mind, even write down what an ideal response would be, so that she could be aware very quickly, get grounded and centered, and then have an ideal response in mind. And I was eager to hear as she came back. She said it was the best Thanksgiving I've had. And I had encouraged her. There are times when just instantly touching a ring and that focus phrase and deep breath may not work. You may have to call a timeout. You may have to go on a walk or go to the bathroom. But being aware of that process can instantly regulate a state of mind. One pro, for example, because This is a pro cornerback. And in football, it's the play is episodic. It's not a flow like basketball. So there's downtime between each play. So he would be there, and to get ready for the next play, he used this to use one word every time the ball was about to snap. He would just say to himself, reset. And that meant for him to get grounded, centered, be at that optimum peak state. The deliberate practice and performance state and flow was instantly accessed when he did that. So these are simply examples of regulating a state of mind. You know, one common example that you might want to think about, and this is something you'll encounter with every client. How does someone instantly manage an angry state? When you think about what you can do or how we can help a client to manage an angry state, let's back off for just a moment and think about what's the dynamic of anger. Anger is the instant reaction when someone doesn't respond exactly as you want them to, and you expect or want them to, so that the script is broken, and there's the instant experience of helplessness. And that helplessness is just as instantly converted into anger, the counter to that helplessness. Now, it doesn't work, but it certainly feels powerful for the moment. Think about the last time you got cut off on the freeway, and you know, you instantly were angry, and, or am I just making self-statements here, and you realize that honking your horn, being angry, is not going to remedy that situation, but it's simply a way to counter a feeling of ineffectiveness and helplessness. Although it's not really a remedy, it's simply a reaction. So this is an important aspect of how we can help someone regulate a state of mind, to help them recognize a trigger, for example, and to pause instead of react, to have a way to pause. For Barbara, it was touching her ring. For someone else, it may be a gesture or a word or simply a deep breath. To pause instead of react, to recognize and reframe it. This is basically self-directed neuroplasticity. To recognize a situation, if you can determine it, you do it. If you don't, you let it go. Reframe it to what you can determine instead of what you can't, and then refocus on the next step. So this is something that can be applied to any situation where experience would render you feeling ineffective or helpless, to recognize, to reframe of possibility, and then to refocus on the next step. So undesirable feelings, thoughts, emotional triggers become a problem when they're treated like a fact or when they're reacted to as if you are instantly helpless. And that helplessness is only the assumption that you should be able to determine how someone else responds. If that script is broken and you rely on that or expect that, then there will be a reaction. This may be helpful in thinking about things with a client. So Self-directed neuroplasticity involves these three steps. First, to recognize an error message from your brain. You instantly feel enraged, or you instantly feel that somebody should be doing it this way. Recognize the error message from your brain, because your brain is simply doing its job description of repeating what you've experienced in the past. To reframe in a positive, engaging way, and then to refocus on the next step. Recognize, reframe, and refocus. There may be questions about this, and we can return to this in the discussion. So one of the fundamental aspects of how we operate is that there are two basic motivations that we have as humans. One is to avoid pain, and the other is to generate or create pleasure, to pursue pleasure. So what we do then can be understood perhaps by looking at how we're wanting to gain pleasure or prevent pain. Examples of a gain: promotion, make more money, improve our lives, get what we desire. Examples of preventing pain: to avoid change, to buy insurance, to save money, to stay away from something that we're afraid of. So think about this in terms of working with a client. If you're not doing something that you want or need to do, you may likely link more pain with doing it than with not doing it. And this may not make logical or conscious sense. For example, if someone has a plan to initiate new behavior at a particular time, first thing you want to know is, do they have a plan? And then secondly, at the instant they were about to take that step, how did they decide to pause? Well, no, I just stopped. What were you thinking? What was the immediate internal conversation at the time you were about to take that step? For example, did you bargain with yourself and say, nah, I'll do it next Tuesday? Or, well, you know, I don't really think I know how to do this. Or, you know, what was that conversation? Because often, rather than self-sabotage or any other motivation, when someone stops themselves, there is a reason that they're stopping themselves, and it may simply be that they're avoiding what they perceive to be pain, the difficulty, the uncertainty, the unknowing of that new step. So from a coaching perspective, this juncture, this instant, may be helpful to look together with the client at the two coaching questions based on these two basic motivations. What's the greater pain if you don't proceed? What's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? These considerations can help someone look at their immediate decision process that may be automatic and may be so automatic that it boots up a whole mindset that is the result and not the cause. Let's go back to Barbara. For example, when she noticed, let's say, the way her mother rolled her eyes at certain things, when her mother rolled her eyes, Barbara became instantly angry and defensive. And that state change booted up a whole set of feelings and behaviors that she was able to identify when she made her list of the columns that we talked about. And I was able to ask her then at that time, when she got instantly upset, what was the age of that conversation? she immediately knew what I was talking about. She said, well, I'm 13. I'm 12, 13, 14, all over again. It's like I'm a teen, and I'm having these same struggles. So that instant booted up an entire mindset that had already been established and was being replayed. So the mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology was to stay in the present moment and create something new and something different so that she could be aware of this process and how it would automatically seem to cue behavior and how she could address it in a proactive and effective way. She could create a different sense of effectiveness. So how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? Well, there are some basic principles about creating change and making it last. First is to identify exactly what to change. You have to get to the point where you feel you must change something. You must change it now that you can change it. Must, can, will change it. And to feel that not changing it would ultimately be more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. So believe the change will ultimately bring pleasure, to link change with pleasure. So here are some questions for that step. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequence? What's the pain associated to this choice that you've been repeating? What will be the pleasure when you respond differently? Secondly, interrupt the existing pattern. Break the script. That's what we specialize in as coaches. The client is operating so automatically, as we all do, on an unconscious program and telling us how it is, telling the story. And what we do as a coach is simply to break that script. How were you thinking about that to make that decision? What else? Other things you consider. We break the script so that the client together, collaboratively, ideally, looks with us at other possibilities, or simply to resonate with the client's experience so the client can become more aware of that and be more empathic with themselves. So here are a couple of questions for this step. What are the cues or triggers for that automatic pattern or that automatic decision? How do you think of different ways to interrupt that pattern once you've identified it? Three, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have from the change. Condition a new empowering association to the same cue. For example, if you're afraid of something, phobic about something, link feeling strong and powerful with that previous phobic stimulus. When you feel and behave differently, the problem dissolves into the new story. So here are some questions for this step about creating a new association. What's the new association to this trigger? What's the change specifically you want to bring about? Think of the things you'll gain and the pleasure you'll have with the change. And you guys are familiar with this story. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that about 1 out of 25 of his fellow prisoners somehow managed to survive. 24 on average died. So he set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. He found that it was what the survivors associated to that made the difference to help them survive. While 24 out of every 25 focused on the instant death and the pain that was inevitable, the people who survived developed a reason to survive, to create a meaning for their suffering that transcended the moment and the situation. And rather than accepting their fate, wondering why God allowed them to die, they looked at possibility, at what is beyond this. They constructed a reason for surviving, for example, so that they could tell their story to their children to make certain this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference. To substitute, for example, an ultimate pleasure of purpose to transcend the immediate pain of suffering. And they were able to make it through and had a will to live that helped them through these toughest of times. There's a similar, more recent example, and neuroscience has adapted this to call it bright spots. There were clinics on the West Coast, family clinics that were part of a consortium on the West Coast that dealt with the most problem families of anyone in that part of the world. And there were just really difficult situations. And what the professionals noticed over time, it took them quite a while to recognize this and hear this, that for a family, for example, there might be one area where there was not a problem. It was literally that disastrous a population. But there was one thing, one time when the problem didn't exist. So they began to focus on that one time and began to prescribe the behavior that the family engaged during that time when there wasn't a problem. And that resulted in a tremendous surge of cure rates for those families. Think about, this is what we do in coaching. We look at possibility rather than problem. How you frame something from the very beginning determines what mindset you use to engage and develop it. If a client begins saying, well, you know, the problem is this. Well, what we know from neuroscience and therapy is the more you engage, whenever you engage a problem, it etches it a bit further in that pathway, even when ostensibly the reason is to find better solutions. It etches it further to instead immediately framing that possibility, that focus and mindset on possibility engages a very different neurochemical system and framework to look at possibilities, and in doing that, to engage in developing new pathways and new neuronal connections in the brain. So from the very beginning, to look at possibility and how we engage a client to address that. And we establish a model that's being downloaded while we talk about other things of how to do that in a stepwise way, because that's what we do in each session. What do you want to focus on? Where do you want to get to? We're establishing a model out of a whole number of possibilities. Pick one. Let's develop that and have an endpoint. That model is downloaded, and that may be part of our legacy as coaches, is how we're helping someone change their operating system in a very stepwise way. So, some other things that I want to just I want to get your feedback and your questions about this, and looking at the questions you may be having about this, because this is not exactly an easy concept, but I think it's so crucial and so important. You know, let me give you another example. of framing and a mindset. The client I'll call Nathan was a well-known nonfiction writer. He had just had a book on the New York Times bestseller list, and he found himself experiencing what he called writer's block, which is when he called me. By the time he called me, he hadn't written a word in about 9 weeks. I asked him to walk me through his writing process, step by step. I wanted to hear his internal dialogue, what he was saying to himself, just frame by frame. He said, when he sat down to write, he said, I get anxious and I begin doing a lot of different things other than writing. Then I start wondering if I can produce another bestseller or if that was just a one-time happening. And we looked at the details of his distractions. And I simply observed, I offered a hunch. This was a kind of an intuitive gleaning from what I'd heard him say. I offered a hunch in case it might be helpful. I said, you know, it sounds like when you sit down to write, you get really excited, maybe more so than ever, about immersing yourself in the passion you've always wanted to experience. And he immediately confirmed this. He said, he elaborated about how that was so different and how it was distracting. I said, when you read the excitement as anxiety, it puts you in your old story where anxiety equals danger. In that story, distracting yourself was a way of regulating the tension. He immediately recognized that because he had thought he had attention deficit for a period of time, but it was simply his valiant efforts to focus. So his experience of anxiety coupled with coping by distraction were his old story. When he accurately recognized his current experience as excitement, he could sustain his creative state. He also could reframe his excitement as validation of this process and as a signpost of progress. And he was a very quick study. He wrote an even bigger bestseller. And that was a very simple approach to look at regulation of state of mind and the advantage that it could have in doing what he needed to do. Let me pause and put us on discussion mode. There are a couple of more things I could add, but I want to hear if there are questions or comments that you have based on what we've talked about. Thoughts or questions that would be helpful to you? Anyone?
Yeah, this is Bill.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks. I was getting lonely there. Go ahead, my man.
I know. How many are in this course? No. Anyway, it recalls to me the watching pro golfers, and many of them have a trigger that resets them before they take a swing. And in many cases I've seen where they'll maybe tug on a piece of clothing or on their collar, something like that. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I think it's very helpful, particularly if you feel like you're going to do something new or different or do something to get back into that mindset.
Uh-huh.
To find a trigger for yourself.
And I think that's a very wise observation. And I think it really fits with the model that we're talking about, that an instant emotion can create an entire state change, and the whole state change and the content of that time capsule is then seen as the cause rather than the result. The cause is that instant state change that boosts up the mindset, like in Barbara's case, all of that adolescent behavior, word for word, and negative self-talk by negative self-talk, feeling by feeling, was that same experience as when she was 13, 14. It was just repeated. Here's an example that I, in doing some performance stuff, there are some studies that show that an athlete can squeeze a ball three times in their right hand and create an instant state change. I've recently worked with a couple of athletes who don't carry a ball around, who need it instantly and able to do it on the fly, like a polo player. Here's one idea that worked for me, and I'll be happy to share it with you. And it's an adaptation of that right-hand thing, because it goes to a particular part of the left brain that is more self-regulatory. I did, and this was very recently, I did the eulogy for my favorite athletic coach of all time, and it was very meaningful to me because he was like a second dad and coached me for a period of time. And doing the eulogy at his funeral, I was very moved, and I wanted to not be moved while I was talking. In other words, I wanted to not be distracting with any of my emotions. So what I decided to do was to press my right thumb into the bottom of my right index finger really hard and use that to get grounded and centered. Practice it over and over so that whenever I would come to any part of the eulogy that was touching or moving or emotional for me, I immediately did that gesture, and it instantly kept me focused and in the flow of what I was wanting to do and needing to do. One athlete has since used that to successful results. So just a way to think about how we can look at the principles of regulation of state of mind and managing emotions to help our clients develop their own ways to do that and ways to stay self-reflective in the process to really do their optimum performance, to practice and to perform in whatever that is, whether it's executive or interpersonally, whatever that performance flow is, to sustain that state of mind and to stay grounded and centered, to have access to all of the information in all of our states of mind. You know, a simple example, I'll repeat this, even though for coaches who began training at CTA, inevitably they will say, well, you know, I wondered what was the best question to ask, or, you know, I wondered I suggested a model of mindfulness meditation. In mindfulness meditation, there is a focus only on breathing in relaxation, breathing out tension, a focus on relaxation. If a thought occurs, and that's the brain's job description, to let that thought go and refocus on breathing and relaxation. Same with the client. You're engaging with the client for the client's story. If you have a thought, like, I wonder if I should ask this, or let it go and refocus on the client and the client's story. so that there's that flow that you and the client are co-creating with that focus, because that's the process the client is going to incorporate when you're nowhere on the horizon. They're going to have a focus and a sustaining of that focus and that flow on what they're doing, and that provides a model for doing that for us as coaches. It's just one model, but it's consistent with staying focused on the client and helping the client develop their story from their point of reference, not about inserting ourselves, not even distracting ourselves. Now, this is ideal. It takes a while, but it's something that that we can think about. So thanks, Bill, for that. Other thoughts or questions or things or just clarifications?
This is Kay.
Yeah, hey, go ahead.
I use the distraction with my grandkids when they're, you know, starting to get fussy or whatever, and we can change them. But I never really thought about how that works with adults, too.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a great application, you know, to really stay focus on where you're going, not what you want to avoid. That's immediate. That's this second. When you're going around
uh-huh.
the turn at high speed, that's instant. That's 1 second at a time. And that can become more and more automatic as we do it with our clients.
Well, I know it works with kids, so.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Great point. Other thoughts or questions or clarifications? One sort of sidebar comment here that I think it's important that we recognize how difficult it is to help our clients in the change process and break the script, because this is an automatic process. It's something they're hardwired to do, like you drive the same way to work every day, and ultimately after, you know, a month or so, you can listen to a book on audio and concentrate because you got the way down without thinking about it. Suddenly, you are confronted with construction after snake your way through a neighborhood. It's work. You can't concentrate. You can't just make it automatic. This is what happens with our client. Any single step into the new or the different or the unknown, it's a little bit of discomfort. And we have to recognize, I think, that discomfort to be with our client and to empathically resonate, the difficulty they're having just by doing something new and different, even how to read that accurately. If a client takes a step into what's new and different and experiences discomfort because they're moving from the automatic mode, the default mode of operating, if they read that as a discomfort that means they're not doing the right thing, or that my gut's telling me I'm doing the wrong thing, or my instinct says that's not going to work, that's a misread, because that's a misread of that discomfort as if it were accurate intuition telling you what to think or avoid or how to frame it. It's simply the read of a different experience, and that's going to naturally be uncomfortable in the beginning. So I think we have to understand how our clients experience a change or any departure from what's their usual pattern and how they're interpreting that, because that can be framed as a signpost of progress, an indication that they're moving ahead. And they can develop that awareness and that reflection as self-validation and self-affirmation. Now, here's a a kind of a sidebar illustration of how things, of how change can be hard. An engineer named Destin Sandlin was given a bicycle that the handlebars had been welded exactly opposite, so that whenever he turned the handlebars left, it would go right. And he was asked, you know, how long do you think it'll take for you to get the hang of this? He said, well, if I do a little bit every day, I can knock it out in less than a week. He practiced at least 20 to 30 minutes every day. It took him almost 8 months to do it as seamlessly, without thought, and automatically as he rode a regular bicycle. Change is not that easy. It takes a while to rewire, and that's where we come in as coaches to help our clients understand and facilitate this process. Because every change is a combination of learning and unlearning. Sandlin had to unlearn the way it was supposed to go with the way it's going now. So this is just a note to really be attuned to our clients and to engage in this journey and the understanding of it together. Now, I know we're out of time. Thanks for your input. Thanks for the questions and comments and the kind words. Again, whatever you think about and whatever those who are not tuned in listen to on the recording, fire away any questions or comments or things that you'd like to be sure we cover. We'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Thank you.